This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri in the library studios with Robert Haywood, art historian and author. His groundbreaking book was published by Yale University Press and can be found in the bookstore of the Museum of Modern Art in New York, MoMA. That is not bad outreach. Robert, what is the title of your book and what is it about?
The title is Alan Capro and Klaus Olderberg, Art Happenings and Cultural Politics. And it's about the two leading artists who founded and invented this new art form called happenings.
Just tell us, who is Capro and who is Olderberg?
So Capro was an artist. He also started art. He studied art history, and he is the one who initially founded this form called happenings. Olderberg was a visual artist, painter, and he participated in one of Capro's early happenings and was inspired to move into this theatrical form that's called happenings.
You know, what got me when I read this book is the fact that it had never been written before. This book has information that has never been known to art historians. So what made you want to write this book?
Well, first of all, there are books. There's a book by where he publishes the scripts of happenings, this author Michael Kirby, but he doesn't analyze them. It's just published as a script.
But that's just a discrete part of it.
Right.
Nobody has taken this overview of these two in our culture.
No, they haven't. And especially juxtapose these two artists, because they have very different sensibilities. And that was my purpose, was to show two of the primary producers, and instead of lumping happenings all together as just one phenomenon, show how distinct they are in their aesthetic sensibility.
So you got this obsession. Where did it bite you? Where were you when you said, I'm giving up everything. I don't care if I starve. I'm going to spend the next 5 years doing this. When did that happen?
Well, I was a teaching assistant in graduate school, and I had to give a lecture on pop art and happenings. And I did not have enough material to even understand what happenings were. I had some very bad slides, mm-hmm. and that book of the scripts by Michael Kirby and an essay by Susan Sontag and a few other things, but it was not near enough to really give a lecture to undergraduates.
So you had to write the book.
Right.
Yes.
And I was very intrigued by the images that I did see.
Well, let's just hark back a little bit. What made you so passionate about art itself?
Well, that goes way back. My grandmother was an artist, and she, when we would go visit her, she would let us use her own paints, her own brushes and canvases. So she didn't like say, this is children's art. She just sat us right beside her and we all painted together. So I was introduced to art early. I grew up in the South, and art was a form of freedom for me.
Well, read us a bit from your book about happenings. And this is Robert Haywood, and it is a groundbreaking book. This information had never been collected before, and it is really a picture of our history, a piece of our time.
So Alan Capro produced an album in the rock and roll spirit called How to Make a Happening, and it's from 1966. So this quote: "It's a real challenge, a chance to turn the entire country into the medium of a work of art," end quote. Capro is quoted as saying in 1966. In pursuing his ambition to invent a new art, Campro continued to rehearse and elaborate on distinctions between his happenings and avant-garde theater, as well as between happenings and art conceived for display in museums.
So just in your own words, describe what a happening is.
Well, a happening is multimedia. It has a participatory dimension, even though it's a type of theater. There are no trained actors. He was very insistent about that. Mm-hmm. That instead, they're participants, mm-hmm. Volunteers who are involved in producing this scene, and there are scenes that take place in garages, streets, swimming pools, any place other than a museum.
Right. So how do you begin researching something that, a project that has history, culture, art, events, visuals, data, so much, there's so much, then how, as you a researcher, do you get your head around what should happen in the book next? How do you organize that?
Well, Capra was a writer and critic and an outstanding writer, and he published a lot of essays. So I collected all those. I went and photocopied, you know, every essay that he wrote and put together a notebook. So I had that, but I had to get hold of Capro's archives because these were not objects displayed in museums. And that took years of effort to make contact with him and to win his trust so that he one day opened his office door, was filled with 100 boxes, and he said, here.
So you had to personally approach him and Oldenburg,
right,
and gain their trust.
Yes.
And this took years before the years of writing the book.
Right.
You had to fly to places and show up where they were and introduce yourself. And,
yes.
And what do you think they felt about you that gained their trust? Or is it that no one had ever documented them? Or both?
Well, they had been interviewed a lot. And I think because I kept showing up. You know, and they realized that I was truly serious, mm-hmm, and interested. And I was getting a PhD, so they knew I was a serious student. And I had published some things, so I had some writing samples to show them.
And so finally, they both turned over everything to you. Their diaries, their letters, their visuals, their homes, their time. And we have a 200-page book that is a beautiful 12-by-12 book filled with visuals. And it's unbelievable that you could have accomplished this in a lifetime, much less 5 years. So give us a time frame. Capro and Oldenburg are mutually contemptuous of American art institutions. I mean, the 50s was very sanctified and sanitized, I think, in art. And they came along at the end of the 50s, into the 60s?
Yes, the late 50s is when this art form began to emerge and develop and, you know, became more refined over the years as to what a happening is.
Imagine the chances they took, because nothing was at stake in the beginning. At the end, of course, they both were moneyed and wealthy.
Not Capro.
Oh.
But Oldenburg, yes.
I see. But they both took out without very much of wherewithal. And because they believed what?
They believed in the power of art to shape people's values, perceptions, and to open up their imaginations.
But why does that matter? People are still going to put food on their table. They're going to go to work.
Because we spend so much time just trying to live and get through the day. But the human mind is capable of so much more.
And that is why art sustains us. And without it, we would not have a civilization. This book is a great contribution to literature and to art. And I would like you to tell us a little bit about an actual happening, which was called Fluids. And it is remarkable. First of all, you'll have to describe. Is there a piece there you can read?
Yes. I am really so excited about this happening because I never heard of it. I never knew there were photographs of it, documents of it, and it wasn't in the literature that I was finding. So I am the first person to write about this piece extensively. And, you know, I found it so incredible because he envisioned building these 20 walls, rectangular structures of ice. And volunteers, and they were throughout California, and volunteers built these structures. And these are blocks of ice that used to be made and distributed to people's homes and to grocery stores.
Yeah, when I was young, we had blocks of ice. I'm not old, right.
So the volunteers are acting like brick masons. And then these structures were just left to melt. So I'll read you my analysis of this. The happenings involve participants in strenuous physical labor that is rendered unproductive in profit-motivated terms. The labor required to construct fluids is produced only in the name of art. Fluids is not simply subversive because there is no end product to exchange or purchase. Fluids enacts within the public space of the Pasadena and Los Angeles community the strategy that sustains high productivity and quickens material consumptions in a capitalist society, planned obsolescence.
So we all remember the term planned obsolescence. Can you just summarize what that meant in our society?
When in a, for a consumer product like a dishwasher, whatever, refrigerator, the idea was that you would build in a certain lifetime limit so that it would expire and the consumer would have to buy another one. And this was a, you know, manufacturing strategy for certain products. And then it was critiqued by some social critics at the time. So there was a lot of discussion about it, and he picked up on that. And so this idea of planned obsolescence is figured into this as a process of making art.
So it's a commentary on our society and on capitalism, and he has volunteers, college kids, stacking blocks of ice one after the other laboriously, and on, and they melt, and they melt, and they melt. And so I was talking to you before we were on microphone about the fact that it had a material statement, but a spiritual essence, which all art has, and that is impermanence. All of the work they did was temporary.
Right.
Except when it became objects that were distilled from the event, like a mannequin or a work. But their whole idea was perishability, that this is not for sale. This is going to happen, then it's going to dissolve, and it will never happen exactly like this again.
Mm-hmm.
And what is the value of destruction like that? It is destruction to create, to make creation.
Well, so Capro believed that we lived in such an overwhelming consumer society with just where value was in obtaining object after object after object. And that's what gave people purpose, as purchasing the next thing. And his art is a protest against that.
And it has changed the art world forever, both of these characters. Just remind the people the title of this book.
Alan Kaprow and Klaus Oldenburg, Art Happenings and Cultural Politics. I will mention that it's sold out at Yale, but it is available on Amazon.
I'm very glad. They, you know, Amazon does keep some good things going.
Right.
And what do you appreciate the most about this time in history? I mean, this got you by the neck and wouldn't let you go. This, as an art historian, you studied, what areas were your topics of study?
So my primary field was 20th century art. So from, you know, the post-impressionists to, well, I was studying art history in the 80s, so that whole period.
But you love the idea of these scandalous artists, didn't you?
I love the idea of their commitment to invention and to keeping art alive and fresh, and their ambition to create art that had meaning and purpose and relevance to the time they were living. The painting abstractly in the 60s just would not have held meaning for Kaprow.
What was art looking like before them?
The abstract expressionist painters were before them. The Jackson Pollocks, and you know, he admired Jackson Pollock tremendously. He wrote an essay called The Legacy of Jackson Pollock. The Legacy of Jackson Pollock was happening.
Yeah, so, yeah. But what happened before then? Cultural Revolution, what was art like?
It was Pollock was the great innovator in his drip paintings, these large-scale drip paintings that are these, you know, lines that with these webs of paint on this canvas. So it was definitely painting, and then in sculpture, more abstract still sculpture, like by David Smith.
What was Pollock saying by dripping his painting?
Well, he wanted to create an abstract art that had no or little reference to the everyday world. And this art would take you someplace else. Now, formally, his art is about line. Drawing is outlining something, like outlining an apple, for example. He wanted to free line from describing shapes. So line would have no other purpose but to be line.
And you said the magic word, free. Free. And all of these artists were trying to free from something. And in Happenings, speak about how art was an experience rather than an observation. Experience.
Well, that's the other part of Kaprow's philosophy, was that with art displayed in the museum, you have to obtain, as a viewer, obtain a certain posture, you know, where you stand politely and look at the painting and analyze it and, you know, take in that it's an optical, visual experience. He wanted to create something in Oldenburg, too, that was involved the whole body and that wasn't just visual. It was visual, but also was, like I said, bodily and participatory. So it wasn't just contemplative, it was also active.
And he brought in the everyday Joe, who was the cab driver, the farmer, whatever, whoever was on board just to act in his wonderful happenings. And so the value of this time in history, is this the value of that time in history? Could we say the 60s, if you look back at the 60s, we had the Vietnam War, we had all of these ruptures in America, but there was this, amplifying it in form and formlessness. What courage do these guys have?
What courage? Well, you know,
Maybe Capra, they couldn't help
Capra
themselves.
Capra was a great observer of American culture. And, you know, this is the time when the suburbs were expanding, people watching TV, very passive forms of entertainment.
Frozen dinners.
Frozen dinners, exactly. Yeah, which I still eat. So he was, you know, we talk about like counterculture or whatever. I mean, the countercultural part of this is you're getting outside. You're with other people. It's a collective activity. You're producing something that is art, and it has no other purpose. It doesn't serve a function other than the making of art and that experience, but that experience is at such a high level of imagination.
That it wasn't sloppy.
No.
Oh, no. It was carefully scripted, and it was orderly, and it was designed with great mental acuity.
Absolutely.
We have to say that.
Absolutely.
Okay, let's read a little bit more about fluids. Just pick anything there, because I think it's fascinating. This is where they're stacking ice so that it will melt.
After helping and watching the structures take their shape and discussing the event with others, Capra later saw them as a comment on throwaway architecture. As he said in an interview with John Weber, Capra in comments that reverberate with New Left cultural criticism explained to Weber, fluids was a reflection, an ironic and humorous one, perhaps poignant of our whole culture, which is sustaining itself by increasing each decade the number of its obsolescent functions. So that last part was a quote from him. So he's being very explicit about what I was saying earlier.
I think we need to tell everyone who our author is. Robert has a PhD in art and in architecture, the theory of art and architecture.
History, yeah.
And history. And you were a fellow at the Hirshhorn, the, let's name them, they're about Clark Art Institute, the Getty. Name the five places you were an art historian.
So in the art history field, there are residential fellowships. They're very, very competitive.
I bet.
And the Smithsonian Institution has one of these programs. And
the Hirshhorn.
And so I applied through the Hirshhorn, requesting residency at the Hirshhorn. And the first time I applied, I did not get it. I just got pissed, kind of, and reapplied with a lot more sophistication. And so I did get it. That same year, I also applied for a Wythe Fellowship at the National Gallery of Art. And I got that as a 2-year fellowship. These are residencies that supported me to do this research.
What a wonderful thing. And the Getty, and the Hirshhorn, and the Clark. So you have been in the major museums in America,
right.
And you must have learned so much.
I did.
Oh, you loved your life, didn't you?
Yes.
And most academics, well, they can go either way. You can wind up teaching and getting actually eroded, or they can be passionate.
Well, I loved teaching. I did not like academic politics.
Yeah.
But the residencies that I had in these institutions like the Getty in Los Angeles and the National Gallery, the Clark Art Institute, they were incredible places. I was stimulated every day and had a lot of support for the research I was doing.
What is soft sculpture?
Well, soft sculpture is a major innovation in the history of sculpture, and it emerged out of Oldenburg's happenings. His wife, Patty Oldenburg, sewed props for him that were used in his happenings, and they're beautifully, intricately sewn. And eventually, Oldenburg had the idea of to take this technique and produce independent objects, sculptures that he called soft sculptures. There's the cake, the hamburger, the ice cream cone. These are all now collected in major museums.
And some of his work flopped over.
They flopped, they moved, and this is contrary to the predominant forms of sculpture at the time, which were hard, steel.
Right.
And
now I've seen a clothespin. Where did I see that?
The clothespin is something that he started producing later because he had these like fantasy drawings. He would take ordinary objects and blow them up in scale, and they had this architectural dimension. So later in the early 70s, he started producing these as actual
works of
forms,
art, yeah.
Architectural mm-hmm. forms, mm-hmm. monumental in scale. So the clothespin is in Philadelphia.
I've seen it.
And there's these large-scale sculptures are really all over the world.
Where's the lipstick?
The lipstick is at Yale University.
How tall is it?
It was in the Guggenheim Museum for a while for an exhibition. It is about 15 feet. That was his first, but they became much larger.
This is thrilling for me because these are such rascals. First of all, they're very sensual. A lot of their work is very sexual. They yes. break all the norms, and they are very interested in the human body, and they use it. They use naked people sometimes. They are trying to get away from Calvinistic, puritanical American art.
Absolutely.
And they certainly did.
Yes, absolutely. You're right about that.
And you loved that in them.
I loved their daring, their thinking. And
well, place them with some other artists so people know who they were part of. What was their time with other artists?
Okay, so happenings are simultaneous with pop art. And there are some intersections, especially with Oldenburg. Oldenburg and Andy Warhol are the two major pop artists. Warhol actually attended one of Oldenburg's earliest happenings. And Warhol later went on to produce films that are happening-like. So, you know, like I said, this is simultaneous with pop art, and pop art really was the dominant art form of the 60s.
Did they like each other? I mean, they hung out together.
You know, it was a competition of ideas. It wasn't so much a competition of money, but a competition of ideas.
Well, there's a wonderful review of your book, which states, this is a thoroughly stimulating read and time capsule to a past moment in time. Doesn't that make you feel wonderful that you did something that hadn't been done before? I mean, this critic just speaks about it being perfection by a masterly elaborator. That's what he called you, a masterly elaborator. To get this book published, Yale had to send it out to 5 reviewers. Now, here these are 5 art critics who know nothing about your field, or they might know a little bit, but you know all the things, and they don't, and they're reviewing you. How do you feel about that?
Well, so they submitted it to 3 reviewers, and that, you know, got me the contract, and then when I finished, they sent it out to 3 different ones. So I actually had 6 in the end. So that took forever. I mean, I spent half of my time trying to go through this whole review process because, you know, they submit the manuscript and then it takes months to get the reviews back. And then you have to, you know, rewrite parts or add parts or whatever in response to those.
Or Yale wouldn't publish it? Or Yale wouldn't publish it if you didn't do that?
Well,
I mean, did you agree with them?
You have to show. Oh, and then if you don't agree with them, you have to just explain why you don't agree.
So
Yale, as a publisher, was fantastic. They never censored me, even though my book is very racy at times. You know, they encouraged me. They got high quality reviewers. They believed in it. I got cancer in the process of writing the book, and they stuck with me. I have nothing but praise to say and for Yale University Press.
I don't know of another press that could have done such a gorgeous physical job. The paper, the layout, the visuals. Did you have anything to do with the layout?
They designed the book. I picked the photographs that I wanted to use, and so they designed the book.
Mm. And you knew from the beginning that you had something of value. Because as a teacher, you didn't have this information, so you had to write it.
Yes, but the first attempts were not publishable. I mean, I struggled with this, to find a way to write about something that doesn't exist. As I mentioned earlier, I was trained to analyze objects, paintings and sculptures. You go in there, right there in front of you, it's complete. Here, I just had these archival fragments that I had to put together myself.
And they were moving pieces.
And they were incomplete. And so I had to find a way to write about something. You know, I mean, war historians do this all the time, but this is not the way modern art historians are trained. So I really had to invent my own way of writing about something.
So you are creating a process, a work of art, in the process of making a work of art, of writing about it. That's what you were doing.
That's a flattering way to say something. I would say I've definitely struggled in trying to create.
And to become an art historian, what are the hills you have to climb?
Well, to get a PhD in art history from a reputable program, you have to have two languages. Most require German, because the early art historians were German. I did German and French. If you're an Asian art historian, that's different. But if you're doing Western art history, that's what you have to do. Mm-hmm. And you have to pass these two language tests. And then you have to take courses in every field, from ancient art to modern, and then toward the end, specialize in an area.
And what I get from you is the sacrifice, years of sacrifice to put this book together, could not have been done without your passion as a glue. Your passion, I am so aware that there is in this book, on every page, your indentation, your love, your belief in art, your wish to make something permanent. And I get that when I read this book. No, there's no other reason to write a book like this.
Mm-hmm.
It's not dry. It's filled with your humanity. And I would like you to talk a little bit about the literary background that Oldenburg had, and maybe read us one of his poems and talk about his background a bit, because he's an interesting guy. They're very different, aren't they?
They are. They're very different. You know, it is interesting that when you get to the highest level of art, artists are intellectuals, you know, and both Capra was a fabulous writer, and Oldenburg actually studied literature at Yale as an undergraduate.
I wonder how he went from literature to the visual.
Well, he always drew. Mm. And I looked at his drawings as a child.
And we have some of them.
One. Yeah. They're magnificent. But he wrote a lot of poems. He made a lot of lists that I just call list poems. There are whole books of them. They're fascinating in their own way. And those poems, you know, are relevant to his art making, because often the initial ideas were in his writing.
That's different from Capra.
Yes.
He was a literary scholar first. He was a man of many dimensions,
right,
I would say. Well, I'd like you to read one of his poems now. He had a magazine called Exodus. Or am I wrong about that?
The Judson Church or there was a magazine called Exodus. It wasn't his magazine.
I see.
But they published his poem.
Okay. Well, in your book, you have several of his pieces of writing, and people would feel they were very disparate and fragmented, but today we would call that language poetry. But would you read a piece of his work?
Yes, and there's a lot of, cool sounds in his writing. Okay, the walls cry love. So this inanimate object has emotion. That's what he does. The walls cry love. Love is the drying paste on the billboards. This everyday life, Love is the licking gutter chatter. Then the next part is he was living back in Chicago with his family, and he was going to move to New York. So he read this poem about leaving Chicago, where he grew up. Goodbye, Chicago, you big piece of iron, you hard jaw, you black crusher, you swell sweeping eye, you brain of macadamia, you clunker of boxcars, you eye blackener, teeth smacker, asphalt roarer, goodbye.
That is the voice of Robert Haywood, and the name of the book is what?
Alan Capro and Klaus Holderberg, Art, Happenings, and Cultural Politics.
And Robert now uses his talent as a co-publisher of Annapolis Home Magazine, where he writes essays on art and history. And to summarize your book, in what contribution did Alan Capro and Klaus Holderberg make to the world and to art?
Well, it's different, but they created this expansive art form that doesn't have as its endpoint the museum, but takes place and embraces spaces of everyday life. As I said, there was a happening in a parking lot. There was a happening in a swimming pool. And they involved people in active ways. Holderberg also made art objects that are collected in museums around the world, but they're related to his happenings. So their big contribution is what Alan Capro said, an art of the world versus an art of the studio.
Mm.
You're out in the streets.
An art of the world, the voice of Robert Haywood. The program is The Poet and the Poem. We're in the studios of the Library of Congress. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media Production. Post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making the program possible. Funding is provided by the Sinipet Fund, the Rivada Foundation, Sandy Jackson Cohen, and Natalie Canavore. Mike Turpin's our engineer, and I'm Grace Cavalieri.